For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Oklahomans are voting on five state questions on November 6th, and over the next few weeks, I want to get your thoughts on these measures. So we'll start with the only one to actually come from an initiative petition of the people. State Question 793 changes the Oklahoma Constitution to allow big box stores like Walmart to have optometrists and eye exams. Neva, what are your thoughts on State Question 793?
Well, I think it's going to be fascinating because, as you say, this is a constitutional change as opposed to legislative. And I think the fact that it locks it in is going to be one of the big issues I think folks are going to have to look at and what they think about that. When they talk about 47 states already having something like this, 47 states have done it through legislation. We're talking about locking it in the Constitution where the legislature then has no ability to really tweak, adjust, deal with issues that may come up, as we know always do, and they will be basically locked out of that. I think it's fascinating that Walmart took this approach. I mean, they got the signatures basically with folks sitting in their stores, more than double the number of signatures needed. So, I mean, they came full force at this with from a very strong position and obviously a lot of money to spend in this versus the optometrists in the state who, you know, are trying to lay out their case to the points that are contrary to. So there's going to be, I think there's going to be a lot of confusion initially in the minds of the voters. I mean, what this really means, is it about low cost or is it about, you know, a question on quality? I mean, kind of the give and take on all of the issues. And I think this is a good one. If voters are really interested in making an informed decision, they should really look at the information on both sides.
Yeah. And Ryan?
Well, and yeah, I think that when looking at the pros and cons on this, I feel like I'm in an optometry office where it's like, does this look better?
One or two?
And I see both sides of this. What we're seeing play out here is this a global economic issue playing out at the ballot box in Oklahoma, and that is Walmart, Target, Costco, these other big box retailers trying to hedge themselves against online marketplaces like Amazon. So if they can plug in these delivery of services into their stores, that gives them an advantage over online retailers. That's really what they're trying to do here. I think what Neva said is the biggest problem with the ballot measure is that it's in the Constitution, so that if the legislature in a year or two needs to come back and change this, and maybe something comes up in one of these retail stores that they need to regulate or create a new rule around, it's in the Constitution. That makes it incredibly difficult to do. Now, at the same time, I think that some of what the optometrists are saying in terms of what the scope of practice in these retail stores are going to be limited to, it really seems to only be limited to surgery in the retail space. And, you know, there is a bigger question then, and I think that that's what these optometrists are looking at. And trust me, I'm very sympathetic to them as a former rural legislator. Most of my constituents were served by optometrists, not ophthalmologists. You know, they are very critical to eye care in their communities. Is whether or not, if this passes and you have Walmarts or Costco's or Targets or whoever it is plugging these places into their stores, is it economically viable to be an optometrist, in particular in these small rural communities? That may be a separate policy question. And I think one, if we're as Oklahomans committed to making sure that people have access to quality healthcare, including quality care for their eyes, that we need to be investing in healthcare there.
Right, and it's also worse because we've seen communities. Pawhuska is a great example of a community where Walmart came in and basically drove out all the small businesses, and then Walmart left.
Right, and I think that is going to be maybe one of the real overarching questions is, do you have an out-of-state corporation basically come in and in essence, some would argue, take control of a medical profession by how they are approaching this and by taking the really approach of we're going to do it constitutionally, so we really don't have to ever deal with the legislature. The legislature, you know, in rural communities where the lawmakers come back and really would be in a position to hear from those optometrists at the local, you know, on Main Street and be influenced by that and how that's affecting their communities. If it's about a corporate bottom line and they're going to dictate, you know, what the pressure is in terms of sales and the quality and which products are going to be, you know, really utilized and all of those things that have been arguments that have already been thrown out there by the opponents. I mean, again, I think we're talking about an issue that has a lot of different dimensions to it, and folks need to be very deliberate in looking at this before they make their decision.
State House Minority Leader Steve Copeland is calling for a special session to deal with the medical marijuana law passed by voters in July. He and the three Democrats on the committee examining medical marijuana policy say the state needs legislative action to set labeling and testing guidelines. Ryan, do you see urgency here? Why can't we wait till February?
Well, and I think that that's probably just in reality what's going to happen. It seems unlikely that the Republican members of the committee or that the governor herself are going to call a special session. Governor Fallon has made it incredibly clear multiple times that she does not see a special session on medical marijuana implementation before her term's over. I mean, I think that she's done. I don't think that they're going to come back. I think that there are these outstanding questions we've seen in some municipalities as to, you know, how they can zone, some questions about taxation or licensing fees. I think some of those are going to be resolved in litigation even before the legislature comes back in February. The testing and licensing requirements, I think that's a key issue. But at the same time, most of your legitimate operators in the state of Oklahoma are going to be implementing their own protocols in-house anyways. They're working with out-of-state consultants that are coming in. They're going to have that, and they're going to know that the consumer wants that. I think really one of the things that we're seeing right now with the Democratic caucus is a recognition, and we've seen it among Republicans as well, that medical marijuana is an incredibly popular issue and one that goes across political lines, across partisan boundaries, and people are trying to stake out positions ahead of November saying, we're here, we're committed to protecting this implementation and see that it's done right. Calls for the special session, you know, may be one step towards that, but I think it's still very unlikely that we see anything before February.
Even if we don't get a special session, we come to February. Last year, there were competing marijuana bills and nothing really got passed, nothing really got done. Do you think that maybe we could actually see something get done?
I think so. I think for the reason Ryan just stated, I think that people recognize that the issue passed, the voters wanted this in place, and now they want to see the legislature do their work to make sure that there is a comprehensive regulatory process and rules put into place, that all of the issues, including some that are just now beginning to come up, like waste disposal of the marijuana. A lot of issues that are coming up with the first crop, as I understand it, will be available in January. I mean, we've got a lot of things timing-wise that are crunched up against this election. But what I don't think the public wants to see are people pandering and taking cheap shots and politicizing this. Let's do the work, which the committee, I think, is in earnest trying to do. I mean, bringing the experts in, bringing people in from out of state, dealing with all of the parties that have been involved from the beginning in terms of pushing this forward and all the way through the passage with the voters. So, you know, I think there is a process. I think it may be at times, you know, grinding slow. I mean, but it, you know, almost a screeching halt that folks become somewhat frustrated with as they read and watch and see what's going on. But the bottom line is, I would agree with Ryan. It has to move along as best as possible, and then it will be one of the very first major issues that the next legislature will face in February.
And do you think we can actually see some bipartisan work here?
I think we're already seeing it. I mean, Democrats are staking out a piece of the territory, the political territory here. But I think by and large, what we've seen is a real bipartisan commitment to making this work,
especially in this committee and the work together.
And Democrats are doing. I'm sure that Republicans will say something between now and November on marijuana as well. I mean, statewide elected officials. This is going to become a litmus test for candidates. And I'm sure that one of the reasons that the minority leader in the House, Steve Copeland, went in front of the media and said we need to do this is because he and his members and their Democratic candidates across the state, out there on those doorsteps or at county fairs right now talking to folks, they're hearing that they want something done about medical marijuana, that they want the will of the people to be respected, and they want a responsible implementation of medical marijuana in Oklahoma. And so, you know, one of the things that if you're a politician that you have to just let people know we're engaged in this, we're doing this work, and we see some urgency here as well. And so I think that that's what we're seeing. But I, by and large, I think it would be I think it would be a big mistake for both parties if we walk into February and medical marijuana has become a partisan issue.
Do you think so? You see any kind of a special session possibly? Or
I really don't. And the only conversation I've really heard, and I think it's not really very realistic conversation, is that if there were to be a special session, it would be after the November election, you know, but before the full body convenes in February. But again, timing and expense, and whether that's really needed.
And 40% needed, new members.
Needed, yeah. I mean, whether that all makes sense, I think is highly questionable at this point.
U.S. Senator James Lankford wants the federal government to take better care of immigrant children in custody. He's part of a bipartisan group of senators working on legislation requiring the Department of Human Services to do background checks on sponsors who take in the children, as well as ensuring they show up for court proceedings and notify state officials when placing a minor in the state. It also increases the number of immigration court judges, which President Trump has opposed. Neva, how much of a long shot is this measure?
I don't know that it's a long shot. I think really when you look at it, it's a very well-crafted piece of legislation where they are taking really the four major points that you talked mm-hmm. about, Michael. I mean, the clarification of HHS responsibilities, the care of these unaccompanied alien children, the state notification when they come into the individual states, and then the need for these additional immigration judges. I mean, those are points that I think are bipartisan. I think folks on both sides of the aisle see this as something that needs to be clarified, addressed, and quickly. And I think when you look at, for instance, Senator Portman from Ohio, I mean, one of the specific instances that was noted in the conversation was that HHS placed eight children with human traffickers that were forced into forced labor in Ohio. So, I mean, those were specific instances brought before the, you know, committee. So they're not talking just numbers. They're not talking that, look, we made 11,000 calls and 1,500 of them we couldn't get to answer the phone or we couldn't locate. We had some issues with some that are, you know, AWOL or can't be found. It's not a statistical game. It is the fact that it must be fixed, and we're talking about human lives. And I think this is a very important issue, and I'm glad to see that it's being addressed in a very bipartisan manner.
Ryan,
you know, I'm glad to see Senator Lankford step up on this, in particular on the number of immigration judges. I mean, what we're seeing is this huge backlog. There's a really great episode of This American Life that aired on KOSU, I think, earlier this week, mm-hmm. and you can go online and listen to it again, that really did an in-depth look at what these immigration courts look like and what that zero-tolerance policy of President Trump's looks like at the border, where people are being prosecuted, individuals are having their asylum claims denied, individuals are being coerced out of signing away their otherwise legitimate asylum claims. But what I would say to Senator Lankford is that this really falls far short of what we really need from him in the United States Senate right now. The Republicans have such a slim majority in the United States Senate that his voice and his vote carry an enormous amount of power and an enormous amount of weight. And this bill is a far cry from the real repudiation of President Trump's immigration policies that the people of the United States actually need. I mean, we've got a president right now who has separated thousands of families, kept children in jails, that's coerced refugees to sign away legitimate asylum claims. And you know, I think that we as a nation need an immigration conversation, but that conversation needs to be imbued with dignity and respect. And those words are so foreign to President Trump that I think that he's asked that Attorney General Jeff Sessions have a zero tolerance policy towards them if they tried to enter into his administration.
But let's also be clear that many of these issues have been going on even in the previous administration. This is not something that just happened yesterday. This has been an ongoing issue now for years. And I think the fact that we're seeing again a bipartisan effort in the Congress, in the Senate, to address this is significant. I mean, we didn't come up with a 700,000 case backlog with these immigration judges. 80,000 of those being specifically what we're talking about. With these folks in question, but even adding 225 additional immigration judges. I mean, we're having to deal with such a big issue, I mean, incrementally, but the fact that they are systematically looking at it and addressing it at the core of where the real issues are, I think is refreshing. I mean, I think the fact that we're seeing this in the backdrop of a political season when we know that it's a very contentious national picture in terms of Republicans and Democrats competing in many of these seats across the country. So I think you're right. I mean, Senator Langford has grown to be a very strong and effective voice in the United States Senate on a variety of issues. And, you know, I applaud him on this one in particular for taking a very strong stand.
But I think until Republican senators, Republican members of the United States Senate begin to use their voice and their votes to hold this president accountable, what we're going to continue to see are remediation efforts like this. And Neva mentioned that, you know, what we've, you know, the immigration backlog and the immigration problems that we see right now didn't start with this administration. That's absolutely true. But what did start with this administration was the zero tolerance prosecute everyone in a criminal court of law at the United States border by U.S. attorneys and put them into a criminal proceeding that's led to these either family separations or families being housed together in jail-like facilities. You know, that's what's changed here. And in the process, what we've seen is thousands of individuals fleeing economic, political, and gang violence in Central and South America, coming to the United States and entering up into a criminal proceeding. And that's where Senator Langford's vote and voice, I think, could have some influence on this administration, on this and many other fronts.
The State Ethics Commission once again passes a rule saying for 2 years after leaving office, elected officials or agency heads can't lobby other elected officials or use their influence on an agency or represent a third party at the Capitol for compensation. Now, the commission passed this cooling off rule last year, and it was rejected by lawmakers in February. Ryan, why would the Ethics Commission think next session would be any different?
Well, first of all, you're going to have a brand new crop of legislators. I mean, we've talked that we're going to see 40 plus new faces in the legislature. We're going to see a brand new governor. We're going to see the whole landscape at the Capitol changes. And I do think that one of the key issues that we're going to see on the campaign trail this November at a national level, and as we've seen, national politics has a way of becoming local politics, national politics, I think there's going to be a referendum on corruption and transparency. And people are rallying behind this idea that we have to have some accountability, that we have to have increased transparency in the way that our government works, especially as it becomes more complicated and more complex. The bureaucratic institutions of both the state and the federal government are wielding more power than they ever have before, and oftentimes are the ones that are really writing these laws after legislators have gone back home and are back at their county fairs and pie suppers. And so having former legislators that understand that system be able to walk in and have an undue influence and to manipulate that process potentially, I think it's very concerning to voters. And I think the Ethics Commission is right to say that there ought to be this cooling off period. Now, that said, we've had, with term limits and high turnover among legislators, it's not like we have, you know, these storied politicians of past, you know, the Gene Stipes, the David Borens, the folks whose names are household names, and even, you know, Fred Morgan, you know folks from the recent history of the Republican Party.
Now at the state chamber.
Those folks are largely gone. And so now you walk into the Capitol, and I think most agency heads would be hard-pressed to be able to pick out a majority of lawmakers and name them by name.
I can't name them. They always seem so young. Neva, your thoughts?
Well, I do think that the likelihood is that the legislature will reject this when they come back in the upcoming session, because for one of the major reasons, the same one that was used by Representative John Paul Jordan, who authored the resolution opposing it last time, it was overwhelmingly passed in the House, and he basically, his contention was that the rule that they were promulgating really dealt with private citizens, and that they were overreaching. And I think that's been one of the, you know, kind of one of the give and takes back and forth between the Ethics Commission and some of the folks that have opposed some of their suggested rulemaking making is that they have been overreaching. I mean, there's no question the Ethics Commission and what is in place now gives a very open, I believe, and transparent look at what's going on with the elections. I mean, who's spending money, where it's coming from, what it's being spent on, the independent expenditure groups to the extent that they're required to, you know, to do their reporting, lobbyists to the extent that they're required to do their reporting. I mean, there are things in place, and those have grown, you know, quite substantially over the last decade. And so I think that, you know, I think this continued contentious atmosphere between the Ethics Commission and the legislature probably doesn't serve either well. And I think the bigger picture is, how does it serve the public, which should be the overarching question.
Yeah, and this, some people would argue that it was this rule that led to the Ethics Commission being cut in their budget, and now they're suing the state legislature. So, I mean,
I think there's a direct correlation between it.
No, we're not going to step back, even though you've done this.
They shouldn't step back. They're a constitutional body. They are a constitutionally created entity, and they deserve the respect of an institution that's put in our Constitution to make sure that we have accountability and transparency. And I'll agree with Neva that the accountability and transparency is probably greater than it's ever been with the folks that are having to report. But when we look at dark money, when we look at independent expenditure groups, that's getting harder and harder. And with the number, with the proliferation of organizations that even if they are reporting, being able to connect the dots as the average citizen, I think is becoming more complex and more difficult. So, I mean, I do think that Neva's right. They'll probably reject these rules, but it doesn't mean that the Ethics Commission shouldn't keep putting them out there. And if the lawmakers are going to go out on the campaign trail, folks like gubernatorial candidate Kevin Stitt are going to go out on the campaign trail and invoke the Donald Trump outsider mantra of draining the swamp. Well, this is one of those drain the swamp moments. And when we saw the Republican controlled legislature last year say, well, that's D.C. This is Oklahoma. We're okay with it here. I think that we need to reexamine what their actual motivations are.
Former Oklahoma State Senator Ralph Shorty is now spending the next 15 years in prison for one count of child sex trafficking. Shorty resigned his Senate seat shortly after charges were filed over his involvement with a 17-year-old boy in March of 2017. Neva, your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the judge imposed far less time than prosecutors had sought, and yet more time than Ralph Shorty had requested, or his attorneys on his behalf. So I think this closes a very dark, regrettable chapter in the state Senate and what occurred with him being in office at the time. I think that it really gave rise to a lot of folks across the state in really, you know, looking at, again, during the election season, looking at candidates and wanting to really wanting to know more about who's running, what their background is, what their character's like, and you know, hopefully we will not see this chapter repeated anytime soon.
Right.
I mean, I think it's a sad chapter in Oklahoma history. We saw a state senator who I rarely, if ever, agreed with on anything, you know, nevertheless end up in the criminal justice system, now in prison for 15 years. You know, there's a multiple families broken apart as a result of this. And then, you know, it comes to light in the sentencing, the childhood trauma that Senator Shorty apparently experienced himself that, you know, possibly could have, you know, led to the mental illness that it maybe led him to commit crimes like this, or to overlook the otherwise thing that everybody else in their head says, don't do this, that he still went ahead and did that. You know, it's regrettable. It's sad for both the survivors of the crime and for the family of Senator Shorty as well.
And Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.